That's in the air, this could be out. Jarvan's underneath it, will he catch it? He's got good hands, he's got him, yes he has. Jarvan's got him in the deep. Having fumbled all night, he's taken the big one.
The guest today is the former Australian batsman Mike Hussey. He talks about his new book, The Winning Edge, Behind the Scenes of Elite Cricket, his role as batting consultant with the Aussie T20 side, T20 batting plans, captains he has played under, and his future coaching plans, amongst other things. Welcome to the show, Huss.
No, it's great to be on. Thank you.
It's absolutely my pleasure. You have a new book out, The Winning Edge, Behind the Scenes of Elite Cricket, and this follows your autobiography, Under the Southern Cross. What was the motivation behind this book and what did you want to accomplish with it?
I guess the main motivation for the book was, well, as a player at the top level, you're sort of taught about, you're taught about the game and things, but there's a lot of things that you're not taught about. You've got to sort of just sink or swim, really, and you've got to learn on the job. You've got to learn about how to deal with the media, the extra pressure and stress of an international game, travelling to different parts of the world, different cultures, different food, dealing with different coaches and different formats of the game, all different types of things like that, which can be very, very challenging. The game is hard enough at the top level, let alone having to deal with all these external distractions. And so that was the motivation, just to make young players aware and perhaps give them some ideas on how they can deal with those external distractions.
Excellent. I want to talk about certain aspects of the book in detail. Obviously, we don't have time to cover everything. The one main thing I want to talk about was that you spend a fair bit of time in the book talking about players losing ownership of the game in modern cricket, with the number of support staff these days. And you are one of those now. You are a support staff with the Australian cricket team at the World T20. So how do you maintain, you as a support staff, maintain the balance between doing a job and still allow the Aussie players to be responsible for their own games?
Well, I guess, as I'm sort of learning to be a coach, I guess that's one of my philosophies, is trying to impress on the player that he needs to work his way through certain situations and through certain stages of his career, on his own. Obviously, there's lots of questions you can ask, and you can get, there's people to throw balls and help work on your skills and things like that. But at the end of the day, you've got to take responsibility and ownership of your own game. You've got to figure out how you play best, and that's something that I certainly impress on all the players that I'm involved with.
Is that the theory behind why you really got rid of all the support staff at Sydney Thunder, you and Paddy Upton?
Yeah, definitely. We didn't want a lot of support staff around, and for that exact reason, we wanted the players to take responsibility for their own games and their own preparation. And even if if a young guy had some problems with his batting, then Paddy's idea was, well, let's get Jacques Callis, Usman Khawaja, and Shane Watson together, and I'm sure we've got the expertise in the room there to help solve any problems that a young player's got with the bat.
I mean, teams generally have, a batting coach, bowling coach, fielding coach, etc., depending, whether it's test team, ODIs or T20s these days. But you're a batting consultant with Australia. What does your job entail as a batting consultant, and how is it different from a batting coach?
Well, I guess I'm not here for the whole tournament, for first and foremost. I'm here up to the end of the qualifying matches, and obviously I'm hoping Australia can go to the semis and the final and all the way. But I guess the role is very similar to being a batting coach, is that, you throw a lot of balls in the nets and things like that, and then I just try and offer as many of my experiences or my learnings over a long time, if any of the guys have any questions or things they want to talk about with regards to the game or batting, then I'm sort of free and available to talk about cricket, I guess.
You've played your fair share of T20s, for Australia in the IPL and now in the BBL as well. We've heard a lot from bowling coaches, bowling consultants about the plans that bowlers need to have, the first ball and the last ball of the over, the most important, et cetera, and execute the various deliveries, slow bouncers, yorkers, slowers, cutters, whatever. But what does batting plan look like within the scope of T20 cricket? And how do you go about setting one up from game to game, venue to venue, opposition to opposition?
Yeah, well, you probably covered it a bit there. There's plans for different players are going to be different for all the way down the list. And then plans for different opponents, different pitches, different conditions. They're going to chop and change quite a lot. So for me, I try and impress on the players to play your way. Everyone sort of plays slightly different, and everyone has their particular role in the team. So that's probably the most important thing, is to make sure that each player knows exactly what his role in the team is. And then it's about getting him in the right spot, batting in the right position in a game, batting at the right situation of a game, according to the situation, batting to certain conditions. And then if you can get the right players in the right spots, then hopefully they can just go out there and just play their natural game and play on their instinct and hopefully come out on top.
I mean, could you expand further on how your approach was? Because you played at the top of the order most of the time in T20s, especially in franchise cricket. Could you explain how you broke down your approach, the first 10 balls or 20 balls, whatever, because you're not going to face more than 50, I guess, in any given game?
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, I tried to keep it pretty simple. I didn't try and complicate things too much at all, but obviously it depended on where I was batting in the order. With the Australian team, I batted, quite often I was batting down at number 6 or number 7. So you obviously don't have a lot of time to get in and get going, and you might only face a handful of balls. So for me, it was a case of having a couple of areas where I thought I could hit a 4 or a 6, and if the ball was in that area where I could get it there, then just go for it, and if not, I was just trying to get bat on ball and run as hard as I could between the wickets. And when I batted at the top of the order, my plans were again pretty simple. Just normally try and be nice and positive in the first couple of overs, and then I'd try and go, try and get some boundaries on the board between overs sort of 3 to 6, and then just try and take it, as deep as I could after that. Again, having like a couple of boundary areas in your head. So other than that, I didn't try and do too much different.
I think it was your former teammate Ed Cowan. He had written in a piece about a metric that you had come up with, where the average plus strike rate needs to be 160 or more, especially for, top order batsmen. Was that your own work or was it from the team analysts?
No, I certainly can't take credit for that. The first I heard about it was from Scott Styris from New Zealand. Hmm. When I was playing IPL with him at Chennai Super Kings. So, we discussed it, and we didn't really have a measure for a player of who was a good player and who wasn't a good player. The Basra, by adding their average and their strike rate together, then you sort of catered for players at the top of the order where you expect their average to be, a little bit higher, but possibly their strike rate lower. And then also players down the order where you expect the average to be a bit lower, but the strike rate to be higher. They came up with the figure that about 160, if you've got that, then you're generally in the top echelon of players.
How has the use of analytics changed or improved, evolved within cricket dressing rooms? Because you've had 8 years of IPL now, or 9 years of IPL, and BBL, CPL, all that. So there's a lot more focus on, breaking things down into smaller, finer pieces and take advantage of it. How has that changed in your point of view during your career?
Well, it's changed a lot, certainly. When we first started playing T20 cricket, in Australia, it was pretty much hit and giggle. Just go out there and have a slog and you don't think too much about it. But, today there's a multitude of statistics that you can, that you've got access to. Probably too many, really. but the idea is making sure you ask the right questions of the analysts and trying to get the information that you really need. And that might be different for certain teams and certain conditions, you sort of study. Well, for me personally, it was sort of studying where maybe a particular matchup that might suit. There might be a batsman that's got out to left armers more often than not, or they might have struggled against off spin bowling or whatever it may be. So you try and find a good matchup there, and then also trying to figure out where their go to shots are, and obviously trying to bowl away from that or to set a field according to that. So that are pretty much the basic sort of things that I look for.
I mean, you know, in some, obviously in terms of the individual matchups, you know, batsman versus bowler, the batsmen have to take their own responsibility. Bowlers have to realize where they need to bowl for a particular batsman. As a captain, which you are for your franchise, how much of that responsibility falls to you to keep a handle on everything? Or do you leave it to the individual players to execute, know and execute the plans?
No, I tried to take responsibility for that as much as I could. I tried to be as well prepared as I possibly could for every single game and every single player. And then, but then I'd also just leave it a little bit to the bowler as well, just to sort of, you know, he might have a very clear plan on what he wanted to do, and I'd generally back that plan. But then I could always offer some suggestions if required, you know, because I'd done my homework.
There is a, you know, continuous theme within the book about the growth of T20 and how it has changed the landscape of cricket in the last 7-10 years. You know, nowadays players, they're involved in one league or the other for about 4 months of the year. There used to be a primacy of international cricket, national representation, etc. But now T20 has provided this additional pathway where they can completely ignore, or I don't want to say ignore, but that can become secondary. What's your take on it, and how do you see it within the up-and-coming youngsters, both in Australia as well as around the world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure on the right answer. I think what I do know is that amongst the current players at the moment, Test cricket's still the pinnacle. That's where you sit on as a player by your peers, and that's the true test as a player. But you know, maybe the youngsters with that pathway of T20 cricket of tomorrow and the next generation, maybe they see the game differently. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball for that. But what I would say is that T20 cricket has been good for the game. I think it's attracted so many more people to fall in love with cricket. You know, especially in a country like Australia where there's so much competition for sports, so much competition for young athletes to go and play in different sports. So T20 cricket has proved a really attractive vehicle, I guess, to introduce the game to many new people and get these youngsters to fall in love with the game. And then hopefully we can introduce them to 50 overs in Test match cricket after that, and they can stay in love with the game. And plus, I also think it's improved the skills of the players. You know, they're executing a lot more balls as bowlers, under a lot more pressure. Batsmen are trying different shots and a lot more power. And I think that's filtered through to the 50-over format and the Test match arena as well. We're seeing a lot more attacking cricket and exciting cricket, which is good for the game.
You know, I want to get to another topic that you deal with quite a bit in the book, and that is about captaincy and leadership. You know, you played under Tom Moody at WA, Ricky Ponting and Michael Clarke and Adam Gilchrist briefly at Australia, MS Dhoni at CSK, so on and so forth. Let's talk a bit about these captains and how you felt, I guess, as a player within their schemes. Was there any particular one whom you felt most at ease as a teammate player?
It's difficult for me to answer. I think I enjoyed playing under all of those captains, and they were all very different, you know, in a lot of ways, but all very effective in their own ways as well. You know, Tom Moody was a very strict disciplinarian, and he was, you know, hard on the youngsters, but fair as well, and he really made you earn your place in that team and make you feel like you know you had to earn your spot. Ricky Ponting certainly led by example, as did Michael Clarke, and you know, they tried to back you as much as they possibly could and have faith in you. So, you know, you really wanted to play for those guys. And MS Dhoni was, he certainly shows a lot of faith in his players as well, but he's a very calm character as well, and then tries to take the pressure off the players and tries to help them just to go out there and relax and just enjoy the game and play the game. And especially in a country like India where it's so intense and so cricket mad, he's got this great ability just to try and help relax the players and to get out there and enjoy the game.
As you mentioned, you know, some of the captains are very calm. They actually show no emotions almost. Whereas some, you can tell exactly what they're thinking, what they're feeling. Case in point being Ricky Ponting for the second case and MS Dhoni for the former. How do players within the team react to those different styles?
Well, everyone's different again, and then some people react differently. But what I would say about Ricky, yeah, he was such a competitive guy and wanted to win so badly, and he backed his players and showed a lot of faith in his players, and you wanted to play for him. You wanted to, you know, you wanted to go to war with him, I guess. And you do anything for him. So yeah, he was a very inspirational captain, and yeah, sometimes emotions get a bit heated, but you know, that's part of the game as well, and that shows how much he's passionate about the game. But MS is a very inspirational character as well. You know, the way he plays the game, he's got a lot of passion, and okay, he might show his emotions in different ways, but I've also seen him pretty fired up at times as well.
You know, you had mentioned this in Under the Southern Cross and also in this book, playing under Michael Clark's captaincy. You felt that you were looking over your shoulder a bit, worried about your spot in the side. Obviously, it's not ideal for any player, especially one that was of your stature and at the stage of the career that you were in. How did you deal with that?
Well, you know, it was a difficult time around the Australian team. We'd had a lot of the greats retired, you know, in Gilchrist and Hayden and Ponting and et cetera. And it was a lot of new faces around the team. So it takes time. It takes time to sort of build the trust and the relationships up amongst the team. It takes time, you know, for the culture to build as well as we get to know each other. So, yeah, it was a tough time there for a little while in the Aussie team, just because it's completely natural. You know, when you lose all those great players who have been playing together for over 10 years, they know each other inside and out. They're like brothers. And, you know, they trust each other and they've got great relationships. And then suddenly you've got five or six or seven guys that you have never really played with before, and so it takes time. It takes time for those new relationships to build. And yeah, it's difficult, but, you know, I really felt like we grew, you know, grew well as a team.
I mean, the team culture and philosophy. Obviously, when you play together as a team for a long time, you go through the ups and downs, you know, you develop this intangible bond. However, as we see now, you know, players spend 4 to 5 months on the road playing for various franchises around the world, and then they fly in to play for the national teams, go away again, so on and so forth. How does that, you know, first of all, change as a team dynamic, and two, the modern player's mindset of, you know, okay, I'm a professional and this is what I'm expected to do. You know, I need to put up the numbers. This is my job, more than, you know, being part of a family, a culture, you know, a team philosophy.
Well, I think they go hand in hand to a degree. Certainly the guys in the Australian team, or international cricket in general, that they spend, you know, between 8 and 10 months of the year together. So, yeah, there's always pressure on your you know, self to perform and to be part of that team and to earn your place in the team. But because you've got such great relationships and a great culture, you're desperate to want to be part of that team and part of that family. And so, you know, that pushes you to perform at your best as well. So, well, that's certainly how I felt anyway. I really wanted to perform well, obviously, for my country. Mm-hmm. But because I just loved being around the team and my teammates so much that I was desperate to stay there.
All right. And I want to finish the interview with a couple of questions. Some hilarious situations that you narrate. One where you told Mick Jagger to basically not come into the Aussie dressing room.
I'm never going to live that one down, that's for sure.
What was the, you know, could you tell the listeners a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, we were midway through a World Cup match against Sri Lanka, I think. And
this was in 2007, you know, World Cup, right?
2007 World Cup, that's correct, yeah, on Grenada, I think we were playing, and it was, you know, it was obviously a big game. Sri Lanka are a very good team. They're, you know, we're right in a pressure situation in a World Cup game, and I think maybe Ricky must have been batting in the middle, and Adam Gilchrist, I don't know where Matthew Hayden was, but the manager looked at me and said, you know, I think you're the next most senior player in the team. Mick Jagger wants to come into the dressing rooms. And I said, well, Steve, our manager, we're in the middle of a World Cup game. You know, I don't think he should come up now. You know, I'd love to have him after the game and come into the rooms and meet the team, but probably not now. And so the manager, I guess, sent that news back to Mick Jagger, and once he told the boys after the game, they couldn't believe it. And, yeah, as I said, I'm probably not going to live that one down.
One last question, Hush. You know, you mentioned in the book that you had said no to both Mahila Jayawardena and VVS Lakshman when they asked you whether you would be interested in the respective national head coaching jobs. Do you see yourself becoming a national head coach in the future, whether it's with Australia or somebody else?
Well, certainly not in the short term, that's for sure. I think I do have a passion for coaching and being part of the team and being emotionally involved in the team. But I think the thing that is, you know, one of the main reasons why I retired was it's just too much time away from home, and I've got a young family at home, and so to take up the head coach of a national team where you're away for 8 to 10 months of the year is just not sustainable for me at the moment. So, as I said, I can't see myself doing that in the short term.
So once your kids are grown up, then you see that it's as a possibility?
It's definitely a possibility, yeah, in the future, I guess, but just, yeah, not in the short term.
All right. On that note, Hus, thank you so much for being on the show. It's an absolute pleasure. All the very best with the book, mate.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me on.
That's in the air. This could be out. Jarvis underneath it. Will he catch it? He's got good hands.